So hi and welcome to the Movies You Love podcast again. It's the podcast about the movies, about the podcast. Can I tell you that it's one of those days, it's one of those evenings? This is the podcast where I get to talk to a bunch of interesting people all about the movies they love and the movies that help them fall in love with movies. And this week around, I get to talk to Mariah Gates, writer and manager of websites such as Cinema Fanatic and Old Films Flickr, a very cool Tumblr where she tends to post up a lot of images relating to old movies, even with her other site. It's generally a smattering of old films, and if you ever need somewhere to kind of just nudge you towards other movies you should be watching, if you find yourself always in the current ethos and not really moving away, you should check that out. But we get to talk about Martin Scorsese's After Hours in this episode, and we go all over the place thanks to this movie. And I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. I'm sure I did. So go give it a listen now.
Why don't you just go home?
I've been asking myself that one all night long.
So what happened? Why can't you?
I met this girl tonight, okay, in a coffee shop.
I feel like something incredible is really gonna happen here.
So when I got home, I gave her a call. On the cab on the way down here, all my money flew out the window. I didn't really get along with her that well.
What's the matter?
I said, I want to see a plaster of Paris bagel and cream cheese paperweight. Now cough it up. So I left.
Kiki!
So I haven't got enough money to get home until I meet this bartender who wanted to lend me the money.
That's all right. That's all right. Forget it. It's all right.
Cool boy.
So I go back. So Mariah, thank you so much for coming and talking to me today.
Thank you for having me.
This week you wanted us to talk about the Martin Scorsese 1985 film After Hours, which within the canon of Martin Scorsese, I've always found to be one of the oddest films of his, because while he's done comedy before, this film feels almost the most far away from anything he's done before or after. I don't know if you would agree with that at all.
Partially in that the tone is so different, but like thematically it fits, I think, perfectly, because it's this beautiful representation of a time in New York's history, a time and a place in New York's history that only a New Yorker could really tell. And from what I've heard from people who lived in Soho in New York in the mid 80s, it's one of the best representations of what that like neighborhood was like, and how the different kind of people that lived there, and you know, the art scene and all of that combined. So in the, you know, context of Scorsese being like the great New York filmmaker, it's like Scorsese and Woody Allen are the two, you know, if you think New York, you think either one of them. I think it fits.
Well, it definitely fits in the sense of the New Yorker, and I guess in the way of painting the town, which is something he does in every one of his films, because I mean, I can tell you I've been to New York for possibly 3 days in total, if I'm counting up all of the times I've been through there in my life. But I'm sure I've never seen any part of New York City that really matters, or anywhere that Martin Scorsese would show me. But I always feel like I've learned something of that town from watching a Scorsese film.
I actually was in New York in January, and I was eating at a restaurant right near where the apartment where he goes, where the artist lives. And I wanted to go, and I was going to go, and then there was a giant fire, and I couldn't go see it, and it was really sad. So I'll have to go next time when there's not a fire.
Well, it would make sense that there was a fire there, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It goes with the craziness.
But I guess the great place to start, which is where I always start, which is asking, like, when was the first time you actually saw this film?
So I first saw it in 2011. It was January. or really early February, and I saw a screen cap on Tumblr of Paul, played by Griffin Dunne, looking at a wanted sign of himself, and I was like, okay, I need to see this movie immediately. So I added it to the top of my Netflix queue and got it like the next day and watched it, and it was, I loved it more than I even thought I could possibly love a movie. And so I immediately went on Amazon and I was like, what is this movie available? Like, can I buy this on DVD? Can I own it? And it was only $5. And I'm like, what? So I bought it immediately and sent back the Netflix DVD. And like 2 days later, I got the $5 DVD that I bought, and I watched it like that whole weekend. I watched it within a month. I think I watched it seven times. I don't know. It was a lot. It's just so funny. And every time I watch it, I notice, because it's such a brilliantly directed film, that there's all these little layers to it, both visual and, you know, to the script and the visuals of the film, that every time I watch it, I notice something that I didn't notice before. And I've seen it probably 40 times now. And that's not even a hyperbole. That's like a low estimate of how many times I've seen it. It just gets better and better every time.
Well, I'm sure we all have movies like that. Movies that we fall so in love with immediately that we just technically put it on repeat. Like, everyone has that. Like, for me, I think the movie was Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. There was 1 month where that movie just didn't exit the DVD player. But coming back to After Hours, I find it very curious, because the more and more I read and think about this film, is the more and more, while Scorsese always tries to paint New York in a loving fashion, while at the same time talking about all of these violent themes in all of his movies, most of them being gangster movies, some of the most famous ones being gangster movies. In this movie, it kind of gives off a feel of purgatory throughout.
Yeah, it kind of does, because it's, you know, you just can't get home. But I think it's sort of a loving purgatory, because it's the New York that after dark that you never really hear about. Like in Taxi Driver, you have New York after dark, but he's in a taxi, so he's got his own, you know, mode of transportation. And this is like New York after dark when you don't have a car. And that is kind of like anywhere pretty much after dark when you don't have a car is kind of like purgatory. Because you're stuck, you know, depending on public transportation or other people. And, you know, if you live far from wherever it is you are, then walking is not, you know, an option. And so then there you have it.
It's not always the best option.
Yeah.
Maybe people should just make better investments in shoes.
Yeah, definitely. Probably could have walked if you really wanted to get home.
I guess. So you talked about how the look and the feel of this movie is something that attracted to you on your first viewing. What is it that you started to notice as you went more and more into it, into that 20th, into that 25th, into that 100th viewing of the movie?
There's like really little pieces of art direction that show up. Like, for example, in Terry Garr's apartment, she's the waitress who's like perpetually stuck in the 60s. She's got all these little things in her apartment that are really bizarre. Like, she's got an entire shelf full of Aquanet hairspray, and she has like 15 mousetraps around her bed. And you're just like, what? And then also in that scene, you know, Scorsese's really, really well known for his great soundtracks and use of music. He was one of the first to really like push that. And there's this one point where Paul is talking to her about his really bad day, and she's got the Monkees playing in the background, and it's a really, you know, high energy song. And she's like, wait a minute. And he stops his story, and she puts on Chelsea Morning, and it's like a really, you know, somber song. And suddenly she's like, okay, we're good, because she has to have the right sound. The person has to have the right soundtrack for the story that Paul's telling, and even though it's a film, so the film should have the right soundtrack too, and it's very meta. I love that.
Yeah, the meta nature of this film is kind of crazy, because I kind of bring up the purgatory theme, and that's where I have to go immediately, because the first thing that struck me about this movie was when he first got downtown. And he got to that apartment, which you sadly were unable to visit because it was ablaze. We see the sculpture there, the sculpture as he walks in, and it's what he said it was. It looked like a painting. In you, what did he call it again? The Scream? Was it the?
Yeah, the Scream.
And it was just this guy in a pose of fear, of just dread, where he's just it literally screaming at you, and you can imagine that this is what Scorsese wants you to realize, that that Griffin Dunne is about to experience tonight.
Exactly. And then by the time, you know, it ends, spoiler alert, that is literally what he's going through.
Yeah, I mean, that is insane. And the movie as it is a really weird tone when it comes to a lot of its humor, because I think the first thing that struck me when it comes to the actual jokes of it, because there is the oh my goodness, that's kind of messed up that happened in a weird one crazy night jokes, which are fun as they are, but they've been done in movies before, like Adventures of the Babysitter and Adventures in Babysitting, and those movies are completely different to After Hours. But then there are moments where it goes a little dark in this movie, and it's specifically the first time it caught me was when he's talking to Marcy, and he starts to notice the burns on her legs. There's the fire she's carrying around all the while. She starts to talk about the fact that she was raped. Right?
Yeah, and then they never really go into it. She's like, oh yeah, he was my boyfriend anyway. And you're just like, what?
And she just kind of lets it go. She's like, yeah, that happened. It took so many hours. I kind of fell asleep. And you're like, how is this okay?
It's really bizarre.
And I'm trying to reconcile this movie versus what I consider to be a whole genre of ridiculous 80s comedies of the One Crazy Night.
Mm-hmm.
And to figure out whether it's that Scorsese was trying to make that movie, and somehow being more Scorsese than usual, he kind of found a weird art way of doing it, if that's a bad way of saying it. I don't know. What do you?
Yeah, I can. I think it was definitely, like, especially in its screenplay format, one of those One Crazy Night movies, and then Scorsese being Scorsese was like, okay, but I have to do this my way. And so you have a blending of the, like, 80s pop movie with Scorsese's, you know, film school genius. He actually won the Best Director Award at the Cannes Film Festival for it. And I think he made it when he was trying to get funding for Last Temptation, and it was supposed to be a Tim Burton movie, and then he read the script and was like, hey, Tim, can I direct this? I need a stress reliever. And Tim was like, sure. And you know, that's how we end up with Scorsese making this comedy. And so it's kind of his, like, a stress reliever, you know, and you can see that. You can feel the joy he had making it. And you know, I think most of his movies, he's trying to, like, shoot for something greater as an artist, and with this one he was like, I'm just gonna have fun, and because he's an artist, he made something greater.
I mean, we're talking about a movie in which, while it's a Scorsese film, it still remains an 80s one night crazy movie, where we end up having Cheech and Chong cameo in the film.
Yes, exactly. And then you have this really great ending where, instead of going home, he goes back to this work, this drudgery job that he hates. And it's kind of wonderful, because they didn't know how to film. They didn't know how to end the movie. They had all these suggestions. And finally, what is his name? Powell? From Powell and Pressburger? Why can't I remember his first name? Oh, Michael Powell, who was Thelma Schoonmaker's husband, was like, he needs to end up back at work. And because that's where you first see him. And that's how they came up with that ending. And you're like, whoa, that is right. That's the only way you could end it. Because it's like a full circle of purgatory and of that hell. I also love how it's majorly inspired by Kafka. So you have all these weird Kafkaesque moments. And then you have this specific moment at the the club where he's trying to get in, and they completely, utterly reference Kafka. And I actually saw this movie before I saw The Trial, the Orson Welles version of the Kafka story. And so I'm watching The Trial like months later, and I noticed that I was like, "What? How come I recognize this?" And then I looked it up, and it was because it was in After Hours, and you're just like, "Whoa, whoa, this is too much."
I was just doing a little bit of reading about the production of this film, and you mentioned it already that Tim Burton was apparently supposed to direct this movie. And weirdly enough, I kind of realized that if someone had just not told me it was a Scorsese film and had written Tim Burton on instead, it kind of feels like it's a Tim Burton movie. It kind of feels like Edward Scissorhands, just a little bit more kinetic, if that's the best word.
Yeah, it's definitely the root of the story is definitely the kind of story that Burton used to tell. Like you can see he would be attracted to it. But it's also, similar to the kind of stories Scorsese always tells, because he tells like the darker side of everything, and you've got like the dark artists and their struggle, and I don't know, I love it. I also like that most of the characters, like, whenever Paul's trying to tell his story, because he's quote unquote the lead character, he's always trying to tell people his story. And in a normal movie, people would listen because they're the supporting characters. But nobody ever wants to listen to his story because they're all too busy trying to tell their stories because nobody is a supporting character. And so it feels more like real life, but it doesn't feel like what we're used to when we see a movie. Because we're used to the language of cinema being lead character with a bunch of supporting characters. And I just think that's really genius.
That's interesting, because I didn't really catch... I mean, I saw moments where he was telling his story, and every time it just didn't quite work out. Like, I think my favorite is the first one with Kiki, where he's massaging her and telling her this story about burn victims, and she just falls asleep.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. When he's with Catherine O'Hara, and he's trying to, call his friend or whatever, and she just keeps telling him about her Mr. Softy truck. He's just like, "I just want to tell you what's happening." And she's like, "I really love my life, okay?" And it's like, in a normal movie, she'd be listening and be like, "Yeah, that really sucks." But instead, she just wants to tell him about her Mr. Softy truck. I don't know. Wonderful.
And I guess that kind of plays into the idea of the movie itself, which is that After Hours, the rules are different.
Yeah. I also love that the guy who says that line is Dick Miller. Like, the greatest character actor of all time. He's in every movie. Every movie.
I don't think I'm quite familiar with him specifically.
He's amazing. They're actually making a documentary about him called That Guy Dick Miller, because he's that guy. Because most people don't know his name. They just know him as that guy. He was in my favorite Corman film, A Bucket of Blood. Which is a really great, it's similar kind of to After Hours in that it's about the like beatnik art scene. So they're connected kind of, but it's a horror film because it's Roger Corman.
Oh, you Roger Corman.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
So there's something about this movie which I can't quite put my finger on, because I mean, I've said it a little bit. It feels so unlike Scorsese, but at the same time, so much like him because of the style that he puts into it.
Yeah.
How is it that you kind of reconcile what it is Scorsese is trying to achieve here? You say that it's a stress reliever. Is that just it? Is there nothing else we can really say that he's looking to achieve with this movie on a whole? Because every one of his films feels like an achievement that he's making, like he's trying to say something unique.
Well, I think, like I said earlier, it's his ode to New York After Dark, but instead of the gritty New York After Dark of downtown, that you see in Taxi Driver, it's New York After Dark with all of the artists and the bohemians and the like yuppies, you know. So it's like a sort of almost a Lynchian take on, you know, upper crust New York after dark instead of his normal like average person. So maybe it, you know, it's his sort of way of saying that that yuppiedom is in itself purgatory. I don't know.
So let's move a little bit away from the film itself. I'm curious, you saw this film in 2011, that's 2 years ago. How is it that you feel the movies that you're interested in has changed after watching this film from before?
Let's see. Well, I've always been a fan of like everything. So, you know, I've never been like, I only like this genre. So it hasn't really changed too much in that, I still watch pretty much movies from every era, every genre, every everything. But it was the movie that did make me decide to finally finish Scorsese's filmography. So over the course of 2011, I watched all of the Scorsese films that I hadn't seen. Like, at that point, I hadn't seen Kundun, which I don't think anyone has seen that movie, because it's his Dalai Lama movie. And I hadn't seen his remake of Cape Fear, and I hadn't seen New York, New York, and I hadn't seen The King of Comedy. And I feel like the one I left for last was The Last Temptation of Christ, because I wanted to watch like this big epic, you know, like I think of all of the films he tried to get made, that was the one that took the longest, other than his non-produced Frank Sinatra biopic that has been ruminating for like 10 years. But up to that point, you know, The Last Temptation of Christ, it took him like 10 years to get funding, and, you know, and it was a really personal film for him because it was about, you know, basically the Catholic Church. And I hadn't seen Who's That Knocking at My Door, which is his first one, which I also really love.
I mean, I have a lot of Scorsese blind spots myself. I mean, I know I haven't even seen Kundun yet.
Yeah, that was hard to get through because I was like, why do I care? Which sounds awful, but, you know, I don't know. I couldn't relate to it, I guess. It looked really pretty. But that one is where, like, how do you fit that one into Scorsese's filmography? Because it's not New York at all. It's not even America. It's not the Catholic Church. It's, like, nothing that he normally, you know, makes a film about. But, I mean, I guess it's because it's the child is going through a crisis of faith, and a lot of his characters go through crises of faith, so I can kind of see that working, but I don't know. I feel like I need to watch it again.
A movie always... Wait, no, I shouldn't say that, because I saw some movies again, and that didn't work out. But I trust Scorsese to say that you should probably try it again, even though I haven't seen it.
I mean, because I didn't hate the movie. It wasn't like, oh, I hate this movie, but it was more like, oh my god, this movie is still on. Wow. But I also watched it on a really small television, so maybe, you know, it's one of those movies where the scope is really important, and I should have watched it with, like, surround sound and a giant widescreen TV. I don't know.
That's entirely possible. Like, I find more and more nowadays, because I've always heard people say this, and I've always disagreed to a certain amount on people saying you should see it on the big screen, because for the truth and fact, for me, I don't have that opportunity a lot of the time, especially not even just for classic films, but for a lot of smaller movies or some mid-tier films to even big movies where they just don't see my area as a market for it. So I kind of, every other movie is always a small screen movie for me, which is at home on my television. But more and more nowadays, when I'm going to the theater more, I feel a slight bias towards the theater where I see myself wanting to like movies more when I see it on a big screen, and I think that's very strange.
Yeah. Well, I realize that some movies, like, not so much nowadays because of the advent of television, but once upon a time, many a film was designed solely to be seen on the big screen. Like, they had no idea that TVs were going to be a thing. So, like, I saw Kubrick's 2001 on the big screen for the first time a couple years ago. And there's a lot of really, really little intricate details in that of that film that you can't see on your television. Even if your television's huge, like, it's still so small a detail that unless you're on a 50 bajillion foot screen, you're not going to see it. And, you know, nowadays they wouldn't put a detail like that into a movie. But Kubrick in the late 60s was like, TV, psh, this is for the big screens. And so, you know, he could do something like that. So every once in a while, you know, there's a film where I'm like, okay, yeah, this definitely needs the scope of a giant movie theater screen to really get what the filmmaker is trying to do. And I think maybe Kundun, because it's so epic that it's probably one that if I saw it on the big screen, I would like it a lot better.
So part of the point of a lot of these conversations that I've been having so far are to talk about movies that helped you fall in love with movies that were so integral to this process. And it seems to me that you've picked a movie which kind of fell out of that process, that it wasn't the movie that started your love, but it definitely did something for you. So my question is there something specific about this movie which felt to show you something that you didn't know could happen with movies?
Yes, in that it was a director who didn't normally make comedies, making a comedy and making it so well that it made you wish he made more comedies. Like, you know, comedies used to be, well, comedies still kind of are Hollywood's bread and butter, but comedies used to be way more well-regarded in Hollywood. You know, in the 30s and 40s, comedies were, you know, like Preston Sturges and Billy Wilder. They were making comedies and the critics loved them. Everyone loved them. And then somewhere in like the 70s, sort of in late 60s, comedies sort of disappeared. And with the American New Wave, it was like serious movies. That's what we must have. Those are what critics love. And so we have all these directors making these serious films. But except for Woody Allen, but who's his own genre, you know. But then you see somebody like Scorsese making a grade A, freaking hilarious comedy with all his really great technical skills, and you realize that comedies can be really great and can be just as critically acclaimed and well regarded as their serious, you know, counterparts. But if these great directors don't make them, then we continue to get, you know, shit comedies that everyone hates or that critics hate at the very least. And it just made me wish that he picked comedies like that more often, because he clearly has a very wicked sense of humor. And, you know, we could have like the thought of having, you know, multiple Scorsese comedies is just one of those things I wish existed. It kind of looks like his next one. It looks more, I mean, the trailer made it look more like a comedy.
The Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah, that trailer was definitely cut to look like a comedy. So I'm hoping maybe he's returned to dark comedy, because he can clearly do that.
Personally, I don't think it looks like a comedy. I think it looks fun. I think it looks like one of those movies where for at least the first two-thirds, we, just like the character, are going to be having so much fun with this world that he's been given, and then we're probably going to be turning somewhere else as it goes to the end. I have no clue what the story does, but, you know, you can kind of see these things sometimes.
Yeah.
And that fun will turn into laughter and comedy as it happens. But I don't think it'll be in any way comedic in the way that After Hours is. But that's just my interpretation of what I saw in the trailer.
I have no idea what the trailer's about. I mean, what the movie's about. I try to avoid synopsises if I can help it.
I just watch trailers. Like, I even watch too many trailers sometimes. I've found that I've gotten into that horrendous habit. Like, especially like this summer with some of the movies. I think with Man of Steel, I probably watched like six of the trailers. I'm like, I want more Superman pictures because I don't have the movie now. But coming back to Scorsese, I'm going way too far away. You talk about Scorsese discovering that he can make comedies and making comedies in a way that becomes critically acclaimed and something that isn't what's happening right now in the 80s, because the 80s is nothing, if nothing, a dearth of comedies, but comedies of a very lighthearted and silly nature.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry, I had a screen cap. I apologize.
No problem. The
happened.
What was I? I'm so lost now. Anyways.
Oh, dearth of comedies. Dearth of comedies.
Yeah. So how was it for you when you finally discovered The King of Comedy? I mean, I kind of see that as the same level of comedy of After Hours.
Well, that one's much darker, though. It's much, because it's about a crazy person, you know, it's about a crazy person and an asshole, basically. Can I say that? I don't know.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Because, you know, like, one of my favorite scenes in that one is when, Rupert is like, wow, I see how you've changed with your celebrity or something like that. And then Jerry Lewis is like, no, I was always an asshole like this, you know, and you're like, whoa. So it feels like Scorsese sort of showing the ugly underbelly of both celebrity and celebrity worship. Which is interesting because it's gotten even worse in the last 30 years, you know, and you see that movie now and you're like, wow, this is not even, we're not even into like how crazy celebrity worship has gotten.
I'm not quite sure if I'd say it's gotten worse. I mean, I think the interaction has become a little bit more easier, but I don't know if I'd say it's gotten worse.
I think it has in America for sure. Like, people, you know, people used to maybe, you know, write fan letters or whatever, but now people emulate celebrities, I think, more than they used to. I think either that or the kind of celebrities that they worship has altered with, you know, the kind of things that are popular now, and so it just seems worse because the emulation is not of, like, you know, Joan Crawford anymore. It's Paris Hilton, and that's just really depressing.
Oh, every time I see someone say Kim Kardashian is their hero, I cry.
Yeah, well, at least she's with Kanye now. That's, you know, like Kanye. But yeah, it's depressing.
So there has been a horrendous shift in popular culture over the last 50 years, but there's always been that world of people consuming popular culture and emulating popular culture to be like that. It's just sad that the world has gotten to this point where Jersey Shore is popular culture now.
Yeah. Yes, I definitely agree with that. But that's why I don't watch TV.
Well, I mean, you always have all of the Adam Sandler movies to help cue you into these things.
Yeah. Although I did like his movies in the 90s. He had some good stuff in the 90s. I don't know what happened in the last, you know, 10 years.
So we were talking a bit about generally the idea of these critically acclaimed comedies. And I kind of think about recent comedies nowadays to trying to figure out what's happened to comedies, and do you think we've come back to those critically acclaimed comedies, or are we kind of figuring out how to deal with comedy as a general genre of understanding rather than just a baseline comedy? Because I mean, there's always going to be the baseline Adam Sandler poop jokes.
Yeah. Well, I think most of the comedies in America anyways are being, the great good ones are being made on an independent budget because of the way funding works in Hollywood. They can't make $10 million movies anymore, because if you make a $10 million movie, it costs $100 million to properly advertise, and there's no way in hell it's going to make, you know, $111 million to give you a profit. So they don't make, so big Hollywood studios don't make $10 million comedies anymore. So the independent, you know, studios are the ones that are making them, and then no one sees them, but they do exist and they are quite funny. Which is why we're stuck with the Adam Sandler movies being made by the studios, because they have a built-in fan base and they're going to make money, you know? So it's sort of a vicious cycle, I think, of, you know, you have to spend money to make money, but no one's willing to spend money, so they're not making any money. So the independent movies are the ones that are great. But we've also seen a big rise in sort of the dramedy, where it's not quite a comedy, it's not quite a drama, and people complain about that, but I kind of love them because they feel more real. Like, I saw a movie...
It feels like there's just a character in there who's being glib, as and that's real, as opposed to someone being out-and-out silly.
Yeah, like, I saw one the other day that was most definitely a mixed bag of tone. And a lot of the reviews that I read... I like to read reviews after I've watched the film, not before. And a lot of the reviews were talking about how it was tone deaf, or it couldn't figure out what it wanted to be, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, yeah, I'm sorry, this movie feels like real life. You know, where one moment you're laughing about, you know, a pug that you saw on the internet, and the next moment, you know, someone got hit by a car. Like, that's real life. You know, and I like movies that don't quite stick with one overarching tone, because life doesn't stick with one overarching tone. And, you know, the nature of cinema has been to not quite be real. But I think we're shifting towards wanting to see things that are closer to reality rather than augmented reality, which is what cinema used to be, which is sort of like the shift in novels. Like, novels used to be very heightened and very different than reality. And then we started getting more realistic novels. Same with paintings. Paintings were, you know, really... really abstract at one point, and then they got realistic, and then they went back to being abstract. And I think people tend to not look at cinema the way they look at other arts, and they should look at it the way they look at other arts. And it goes through the same sort of waves, where it'll start really realistic, and then it gets, you know, heightened, and then it gets realistic again, and then it gets heightened. And right now I think we're in a more realistic phase, and I like that.
I think there's something to that, but at the same time, cinema of today, it generally doesn't necessarily qualify in that sense of being the realistic cinema, because we do have that new movement of just, we need to make it real and down to earth. I mean, even when you look at the bigger blockbuster movies, we're seeing a shift of more relatable heroes. We're talking about the world of the Batmans, where he has to be someone who you can figure out that can exist in the real world. But at the same time, in popular culture, there's still a sense of unreality, if that's even a word. I'm just making up things as I talk now, where you think about you come to the realization that one of the most, the highest grossing films of this year was Fast and the Furious 6, which, while all of its elements may be real elements, you know, there are people, there are cars, there are bridges, the things that they actually put in those movies, bringing those things together, are all things which have absolutely nothing to do with reality in any sense. I mean, there was that running joke going online for the 2 weeks that the movie was killing the box office, where Justin Lin greater than physics. But it's just, I don't think it's easy enough to say that movies need to be realized like that. And you bring up the dramedies. Those movies are direct descendants of films such as The Apartment, where Apartment is a film that doesn't, someone who doesn't like it would complain about it in the tone saying it doesn't know what it wants to be. 1 minute it's funny, the other minute it's serious. But the truth about it is that the movie is, as you say, it's real. It's real life at that point.
Yeah, because it goes back and forth between, you know, her wanting to kill herself and her making a joke about pasta. That feels real, and that's why those sort of movies age better, I think. But, you know, like any art, there's going to be people who like one thing and people who like another thing and people who want to make one thing and people who want to make another thing. And I think it makes more sense to sort of understand that it's always going to be a mixed bag and that you can't really quantify, like, movies are like this now, you know? So
I feel like we're coming to an end with this, but I think the one question that I'm really curious about at this point, with Martin Scorsese being one of the most prolific filmmakers out there, I mean, he's no Woody Allen, but yeah, he's definitely a filmmaker who, it feels like his name is always out there with something happening.
Yeah. Right?
Oh, even if it's not him as directing, he's producing something, he's he's doing something with movies. How much of you would you be willing to devote if you heard Woody Allen was making another After Hours-esque movie today?
Oh, if Woody Allen or Scorsese?
Oh, I'm so sorry. My brain just made a mixture there. I'm Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, no, if he was making another comedy, I would pre-order my ticket today and try to be a PA on it or something. You know, like, I would love to see him. I mean, he has been doing the last 10 years he's done, he did what, Gangs of New York, which was like a period piece. And then he did The Aviator, which was a Hollywood period piece. And then you have Shutter Island, which was like a thriller. And then you had Hugo, which was for kids /
and The Departed in the middle of there, which was a remake.
And it was, you know, a return to like gangsters kind of, and then all of those movies, while they all feel Scorsese, are all very different in the subject matter that they're undertaking. So it's nice to see that he's a filmmaker who doesn't make the same movie over and over again, which some directors tend to do, especially when they are getting on in the years and they're just like, I'm tired, I'll just make this movie again.
You just bring the gang together and you just come in and you're like, just do what we did last week. Do it again.
Yeah, I think he's always sort of evolving as a filmmaker, and I think that's important. And I think that's because he's the kind of guy who continually watches films. He watches the new films. He's always finding new old films to watch. And I just feel like more filmmakers need to do that, because you can learn from your contemporaries, but you can also learn from the masters, and it's important to do both. And I think a lot of directors don't watch anybody's movies because they think, I can make my own and not be influenced by anybody. But that's why I feel like directors who don't try to learn from other people in the craft are robbing themselves of something, of sharing in the conversation, you know?
I mean, they're two complete trains of thoughts, because, I mean, we could even talk about it in relation to film writing online, because there are a lot of people out there who have the mindset that they don't need to be abreast of the culture of what's out there or the opinions that are out there right now, because it's more important for them to come to their own conclusions than to take in what other people are saying. And there is some form of value in that, which kind of allows you to have your own fresh ideas to things. But at the same time, there is value in consuming and interpreting not just the art source, but other people's interpretations to come to a greater understanding to the end.
Yes. I definitely agree. I think it's important for it to be a conversation. Like, I think you can read and see other people's work without it influencing you if you are aware that it could influence you, and then rise above that and communicate in a conversational style. And I think a lot of people don't look at film as a conversation. They don't look at art as a conversation. They don't look at criticism as a conversation, but it's all taking one thing, one person's idea, and putting your own spin on it, which is what a conversation is. And it I think if you go through life looking at everything as one big giant conversation, you're going to get more out of everything than if you just go through life, you know, going, I must have my own opinions, period. Because you can still have your own opinions in a conversation. You're just adding to it.
And I mean, if Martin Scorsese is nothing else, he is a historian and a lover of that conversation.
Yes. Definitely. He's definitely a big advocate of that, which is part of why I love him.
Anyways, Mariah, I'd like to thank you so much for coming on the show and talking with me today.
Yeah, speaking of conversations, this was a great one.
So, that was the podcast. You know all the stuff about it. I hope that you guys will go and give it a listen. I should apologize, though. There should be one thing that I apologize, though. I misused the word dearth in the podcast. It was completely a mind fart. It was completely unfigured out. I mean, I generally do this when I'm talking. I'm probably doing it right now, where I have an idea in my head I want to say, and then I try to be smart, and then it comes out completely wrong. And it happened right there. So yes, when I said dearth there, I didn't mean dearth. It was just stupid of me. And I hope you listening kind of figure that out and had a good laugh, because I would have laughed as well, and just moved on. But yeah, otherwise, great episode. And yeah, so as always, you can find the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, on the website at gmanreviews.com. Feel free to leave me a comment, leave me a review on iTunes, leave me a rating. Go say something nice, go retweet it, go tell your friends about it, go do all sorts of awesome things, because we just want more love. We want more love about the podcast, we want more love about the movies on the podcast, we want more love about generally most things. So thanks so much for listening, and good night. I don't know if I'm ever coming home.